you ask what can make climate policy worth a politician's time, I think the answer is to make climate policy deliver something that politicians can take credit for.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Climate change is already having a profound effect on the lives of ordinary people in developing countries, but do those people connect their lived experience to their government's climate policies? And if not, who can join the dots to create greater understanding and incentive for better policy? Guy Grossman of the University of Pennsylvania is one of the authors of a new review of the politics of climate change in developing countries. He joins me now. Guy, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me on the show.
The forecast is pretty bad, isn't it, about the human and the economic impact of climate change in low-middle-income countries?
Yeah, well, there's no single forecast. You know, it depends a lot on which scenario we're going to land on, whether it's 1.5 Celsius, 2, maybe worse. I think the picture is pretty clear, even if the exact numbers are not. One headline estimate is that climate change could push anything between 32 and 132 million people in developing countries into extreme poverty in the next decade. And even if we are going to end with the low end of the projections, we're talking about millions of people here. Poverty is just a part of the story. Climate change also means harvest failing as rains turn more erratic, and that means more hunger and malnutrition as food is going to be scarcer, but also rising death, right? Especially from heat in places where health systems are readily stretched. So the cruel part is this asymmetry, right? That these are the regions that did the least to cause the problem, and they have the least capacity to cope with it. If we look at like developing countries, they contributed only a small share of historical emissions, maybe something around 3%. But as a share of their income, the losses are going to run something like 60% higher than rich countries.
Yeah, now this clearly demands a policy response. But my impression from the research that I've read is that a lot of the research into climate change policy, it's based around high-income countries. Is that what you discovered in your research?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was prime motivation to writing the paper in the first. The irony is, even though the developing world is where climate is going to hit hardest, it's already hitting hardest, and where countries are least equipped to cope, it's also the case that almost all the research is concentrated in rich countries. We definitely find it, right? Like, this is about US and European public opinion or design of EU carbon markets. There's a lot of work on international negotiations. I talk to my students about the fact that we know a lot about how German voters feel about carbon taxes, but we know almost nothing about how farmers in the Sahel experience a failing harvest and what do they do about it, especially politically. And just to be clear, I mean, there's some justification, right? Like wealthy countries, they produce most of the historical emissions, right? And so they bear more responsibility to act. So concentrating on high-income countries is not completely unreasonable. But this like high concentration of research overlooks the basic reality that the current impact, and I would also argue some of the hardest political problems, are concentrated in low and middle income countries. We end up in a world in which the richest kind of like science of climate politics is concentrated in part of the world that is relatively insulated for climate change. And the thinnest part of our understanding is on parts of the world that we can think about it as the front line of climate change.
Yeah, I also note in your review, you find this split between what you would call environmental policies and politics and climate policies. They sound like the same thing to me.
Yeah, well, it's a good point. And I think maybe it's worth clarifying what we mean by these two terms. So maybe kind of going back historically, how these like two fields evolved. So environmental politics developed around understanding relatively concrete local fights. So think about who gets to log the forest or who's dumping into the river or which neighborhoods end up next to a polluting factory. A lot of the work on environmental politics was focusing on enforcement, and especially weak enforcement. So there's a rule in the book, but it gets applied for some and not others. Maybe because politicians are trading a logging permit for political support. Climate politics, that was developed instead in the different kind of school of thought, mostly in international relations. It's treating climate as a global problem, especially a collective action problem between government. So the focus of climate politics has always been about treaties and summits, you know, in Kyoto, Paris Protocol. And you can think about environmental politics leaning heavily on distributive politics, basically who wins, who loses, when we're thinking about these controls over local resources. But climate politics is more about coordination. So one field is looking down at the village stream and the other is looking up at Paris.
But if these two strands of research are separate and they aren't brought together, why does that matter? Why is that a bad thing?
Well, I think it matters because at least in the developing world, climate change becomes political through local environmental decline. Okay, I mean, farmers don't experience anthropogenic forcing. What do they experience? I mean, they experience a river that dries up. They experience soil turning salty. They experience when the forest is being cleared. And so our research suggests that environmental degradation, and I would put a big focus here also on pollution, is the entry point through which people first encounter climate change. Now, the thing that we lose analytically is if you think about the environmental policy, politics analytical tool, so this could be about weak enforcement, we talked about the distributive conflict, you can think about clientelism, you can think about elite capture. It's actually a framework that is very useful to explain climate outcomes in low and middle income countries. But because these two fields stayed separate for so long, it was hard to connect things like deforestation as a local issue to deforestation as a carbon sink destructive issue. In rich countries, you can study them separately, right? You can have a debate in Europe on carbon taxes. You can debate carbon emissions, and you can do that separately from local environmental fights. I think in poor countries, you just can't pull them apart. I think that climate politics in developing countries is environmental politics.
You said before that we know comparatively less about the experience of a farmer in the Sahel, how they're experiencing climate change, than we do about many things in high-income countries. Clearly, you've been thinking about this. What do we know about levels of climate awareness or concern or knowledge that ordinary people in developing countries have?
Maybe I should start by saying, why should we even care about like mass public attitudes? Mm-hmm. Why is it such an important avenue for research? I think it's natural to think about this idea that governments will be more likely to act on climate when citizens demand it, right? Like if people doubt the urgency of the climate crisis or the human cause of it, they won't support costly mitigation policies. So we should care about it. What we find in our research is this interesting paradox that exists in developing countries and less so in high-income countries. And that is in low and middle-income countries, awareness of human-caused climate change is quite uneven and generally low. In some recent surveys, for example, just something like 4 out of 10 people in Africa pointed to human activity as the main cause of climate change.
Wow.
But concern, on the other hand, is high, right? Over 80% across Africa and Asia, about 90% in Latin America. And these are figures that match, even exceed, rich countries. So what I want us to take from that is concern about the climate doesn't necessarily come from understanding the science or even knowing that it's like a global human-caused phenomena. It comes from the lived experiences of local environmental change. People don't need to grasp what's happening to the planet, right? To know that rains where they live have become unreliable and that has like implications for their livelihood. And I think the reason it's so important to really dig into the public opinion data, at least the one that is available, is it helps flip some assumptions that people were making For example, there was like this assumption widely held that inaction in low-income countries is a pure demand problem. Right? People just don't care. Right? But what we show concern is there. People do care and they are highly concerned. But the real bottleneck is more downstream, right? Like, how do you turn a concern into political pressure? And then how do you get government to respond? Locating where the gap is really important, because without locating the gap, it's hard to come up with solutions.
And today, you mentioned many of the problems that farmers, ordinary people, are experiencing. If I am that farmer and I don't conceive these impacts as a political problem, there's something that I have to deal with. I have to deal with them right now. What do I do about it?
Well, what do? You adapt, right?
Yeah.
But you do it usually, we can think about it privately, and you adapt locally, right? And so maybe you switch crops, maybe you buy drought-resistant seeds, you change planting times, you might dig wells, you might adopt irrigation, you might diversify your income out of agriculture. What you don't do necessarily is vote out the incumbent over the action or inaction of climate, right? If you haven't connected your private misfortune to a public failure, then there's no political ask. I think political science of climate change teaches us that your experience will turn into political pressure. For that to happen, you need some interpretive frame, right? You need something or someone that will say, well, this is not just bad luck, right? Like, this is not just God's will, right? It's a collective problem. And there's someone in power that could have done something, okay? And so I think, importantly, these frames usually come from outside, right? From the media, from opposition politicians, from local leaders. But without these types of frames that connect your personal problem to a collective problem, adaptation will be private. And I think most critically, it's going to be apolitical.
And it's going to be costly as well. If I'm that political incumbent, is there a sense that I'm getting let off the hook by the fact that there isn't this interpretive frame?
Absolutely. If households self-protect, right, they say, I don't know, I invest in private cooling, it dampens demand on government. You can think about it as a pressure valve that gets released. The quintessential example is migration, right? Which is an adaptive behavior. If people vote with their feet instead of voting the ballot box, well, then the government really has no pressure to build the adaptation infrastructure that is needed. It's not just about getting the state off the hook. It's also that private adaptation widens a gap, because some families can afford maybe a borehole or a pump, invest in like irrigation, or just move away, right? And they're going to be fine. But the families that can't, those are left exposed to the floods. At the very deep sense, if we only have self-protection, this will be a privilege of those that can pay for it. I don't even push it further. There's even a darker version, what the academic literature refers to as maladaptation. And that's kind of the idea that private adaptation without government coordination can shift harm into someone else. So the classic case is, think about like an embankment, right? I protect my village by pushing flood water into the village next door. So at the extreme, one person adaptation, again, without government coordination, can become another's exposure.
Also, as the incumbent, can I be the hero here and fix the immediate problem, distribute some relief or something like that, without then getting involved, because I've got no bottom-up pressure to respond to, without getting involved with fixing the underlying problem?
There's not a lot of bottom-up pressure in developing countries for vast mitigation. When there's some pressure, it's usually about immediate, local, very physical harm, like relief from floods or from a failed harvest. But again, not about big mitigation. The pressure that does exist on politicians is usually on adaptation and disaster response, not the carbon economy. Politicians do feel heat to deliver relief, but not necessarily to protect the forest or to price carbon. There's pressure to treat the symptoms, not the cause.
So guys, a politician, in the name of growth, I can do things like raise a forest or I could build on a floodplain. Does that mean that climate vulnerability is just something that I've inherited, or am I producing climate vulnerability as well?
When you think about climate vulnerability, obviously, some of it is inherited from geography, but not all, right? It's also politically produced. There's different ways in which it could be politically produced, right? A government can turn a blind eye when ranchers raise the Amazon, green light housing on the floodplain, and all of that in the name of growth. The key things is that these are political choices that manufacture climate exposure. And what we try to do in the piece is kind of pull the camera back and place institutions as the center of what shapes exposure. And we do that by focusing on three levers. So one lever is whether institutions protect or destroy the forest and the wetlands that absorb carbon. The second is about adaptation, whether they build a seawall, early warning system, or, for example, drainage that protect people. And the third, and perhaps most importantly, institutions also govern whose voices count when decisions are made. I think for a lot of people, the natural conclusion might be that more democratic areas might do better than less democratic areas because institutions tend to be stronger. But interestingly, that's not where the research lands. The answer is not as simple as democracies do better. Actually, the correlation between democracy and environmental protection is relatively weak, and it's a bit inconsistent. I mean, just to give a concrete example, competitive election has been shown to raise deforestation because politicians sometimes conclude that they can win votes by handing logging permits or looking the other way when illegal logging takes place. What matters is less putting labels on institutions, is just thinking more about the incentives and whether they reward protecting a resource or giving it away. Floods might be an act of nature, but who lives in the floodplain when the water arrives? That's an act of politics, and many times it's an act of choice.
This is another area where a lot of the research seems to come from high-income countries as well. Is that correct? Does it translate?
Yeah, it's correct. And I would say that some translates and some does not. So here's a few things that do translate, and I think it's important to name them. I think one thing that translates is this idea that distributive conflict is universal. If you cut carbon, you're going to create concentrated losers, and you're going to create also diffuse winners. And if you don't compensate the losers, they're going to try to block your policy, right? That's just true everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I think translates relatively well is this idea that carbon pricing, that is taxing carbon or making polluters internalize cost, is unpopular across the board and arguably more so in developing countries. We've seen it with fuel subsidy cuts that triggered protests in dozens of countries, not only in high-income countries like France, Yellow Vest, but fuel riots, we've seen them across the developing world. These two things travel. I would say there's two major things that don't travel from the study of climate politics in high-income countries. The first one is the partisan story. If you read something about climate change politics in the US, a lot of the focus will be on right, left, identity, or a partisanship / polarization story. Research suggests that at least in the developing world, party and ideology, they matter far less. So the polarization finding doesn't really apply. The other thing that I think is different and is not getting enough attention, and I think it should, is this idea of state capacity. In rich countries, state capacity is relatively high, but the focus is a lot on policy. If you implement something, the government, by and large, is going to implement it. But that's not necessarily the case in many of the countries that I study. The policies could be quite amazing. Sometimes they're taken as is from some high-income country. The fact that you pass something doesn't mean that it gets enforced, doesn't mean that it gets implemented because of capacity gaps. People that study climate politics in developing countries need to pay a lot more attention to questions of state capacity. The underlying logic is universal, this idea of winners and losers, this idea of people don't like carbon pricing, but the political machinery, how you think about the parties, how you think about ideology, how you think about polarization, they don't travel so well. And so just lifting rich world playbook and dropping it in developing countries won't do the trick.
So let's think about what might do the trick. The politician in a developing country gets credit for rescuing for acting when there is a disaster, but they don't get credit for the disaster that didn't occur. So what is going to make climate policy worth their time?
You hit the nail on the head. There's a core problem that prevention is invisible. You get applauded for disaster relief, but no one thanks you for the flood that never happened. That asymmetry goes a long way explaining why climate exposure prevention is so starved, at least politically. But not all is doom and gloom, right? If you ask what can make a climate policy worth a politician's time, I think the answer is to make climate policy deliver something that politicians can take credit for. And there's some good evidence that voters, for example, reward politicians for adaptation, at least adaptation that is visible and attributable to politicians. The real trick is framing policies as jobs, as cheaper energy, as cleaner air, as better harvest, things that people can feel now rather than in 2080. You need to design your policies also in ways that build their own constituency. You can think about the solar installers or the green job workers. They will be the ones that will defend the policy because they benefit from it. This is true in developing countries, but I think this is universally true, right? Even in the US, that was the logic behind Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. Climate policy was explicitly designed in a way to pay a visible dividend in jobs and in cheaper electricity, and targeting specifically places that were least of climate change policies at the get-go. So a lot of like the IRA is concentrated in red states.
You're talking about how people respond to what they perceive. Is the job of researchers here to measure the harm, to produce better data, or is there also a responsibility to communicate that harm in a way that can help build that understanding of what's causing it?
I don't think it's either or.
And do both, yeah.
There's a lot of demand to do more research, and I think research is important. But measuring harm, I don't think is necessarily the main bottleneck today. I think we can already see the harm in the data. The harder part is the second thing that you alluded to, which is the interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
We make that argument abundantly clear in our paper, right? Like the gap is not necessarily that people don't notice climate change or the climate changing. They feel it acutely. The main gap is attribution. So how do you connect a failed harvest that obviously affects you in a very personal way and very acute way to a global human-caused problem that someone could actually do something about? It's not a measurement problem. It's a framing problem. Better satellite map of droughts won't change really a voter's behavior. What's going to change voter behavior is the interpretation, how you join the dots. I think the question is like, who's supposed to join the dots? And I think I'll be a little bit careful. I'm not sure that researchers should be investing heavily in advocacy. And I don't think it's necessarily the relative advantage. And I also think that there's some political risks when researchers do the advocacy. I think our main job is to understand how attribution happens, when does it break, which framings land locally and which don't. But then the advocacy itself, I think, needs to happen in different arenas, political arenas. It could be the media, it could be social media. I think we need to help connect the dots. I think actual work of advocacy might not be in the interest of researchers. Who joins the dot between a farmer's failed harvest and government choice is obviously a political question. We need to understand that translation because that's where politics actually happens. We need to assist those that advocate. I'm not sure we need to be the ones that do the advocacy ourselves.
One way to help join the dots is to produce more detailed data about what people are experiencing, what they think about it. I think that research has found that surveys are under-asking about climate and that donors are not prioritizing that. So who's in charge of setting that agenda? Because we really want to change it, surely.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, survey questions obviously follow the money and money follows donor priorities. And unfortunately, climate change has not been a top priority for those that fund some of the surveys that take place on a regular basis and cover a large number of countries. Think Afrobarometer, the Asian Barometer, the Latin American Barometer. So these types of cross-national surveys, they ask really a small number of questions, maybe about awareness here and there, rarely about concern, almost nothing about policy support. They almost never ask the same question twice. So this makes it almost impossible to track attitudes over time. And obviously, this is a problem. There's a real need to convince donors that climate is not a niche issue. It's upstream of everything they already care about: poverty, food security, migration, conflict. I think it's possible to have this conversation. At the end of the day, what I'm hoping is that the major cross-national surveys will add a well-crafted climate module that is asked consistently, and then the data will follow and will dramatically improve our ability to track the things that we should care about, which is where exactly the gap is. Is it about awareness? Is it about concern? Is it about policy support? Right now, we're now flying in the dark.
If the people who know about this best, indigenous people, people that live on the land, if we're finding because of this disconnect, they're not in the room when policies are decided, when climate finance is decided, how can we get them into the room?
Many times those with the most granular knowledge of environmental change, and these are, could be indigenous people, could be informal urban dwellers, they tend to be, as you said, shut out of the rooms where decisions are made on adaptation policy or climate finance. And we show in our work that this is not just unjust, it's also ineffective. The evidence is quite strong that when these communities have able to secure rights, the outcomes improve. There's a lot of evidence that indigenous managed lands, for example, protect carbon sinks better than many formal protection areas. Inclusion matters, but it only matters when it comes with willpower. A seat at the table is not enough. We cite a study in Ecuador of land titling that did really almost nothing for deforestation, but mostly because the state did not back those titling efforts. So participation without authority tends to fail. So maybe I flip a bit your question. The question is not necessarily how to get some people into the room or marginalized communities into the room. Because getting people into the room sometimes is cheap and many times it's just purely symbolic. Yeah. You need a deed to your land and you need the power to enforce it. It's not just about being in a room, it's having the power to act on your deed. And that's when change happens.
Vulnerability is often produced by the political process. Is there one thing that governments could choose tomorrow, if they wanted to choose differently, that could change who is getting hurt by this?
I would probably focus on securing land rights for the people who live closest to the carbon and to risk. It does three things at once. It helps protect the forest because people will defend land they own. It lets them invest in protecting themselves because their claim is secure. And it gives them voice that they didn't have before. The evidence for that is unusually strong. The deepest finding of our whole review could be summarized as the idea that climate harm isn't just weather happening to people. It's a distribution. And that distribution reflects who has power and who doesn't. Which means that it's chosen. And the good thing is that it could be also chosen differently.
Guy, thank you very much.
Thank you, team. Thanks for having me.
The paper is called The Politics of Climate Change in a Developing World. Authors Guy Grossman, Audrey Sachs, and Alice Hsu. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe. You find it wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, at voxdev.org, where you find articles about the topics we feature. If you enjoy what you are hearing, please tell someone else about us. Leave us a review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zalgarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.